This is Dana Balut.
And I'm Hibe Fisher.
And you're listening to El Empire.
It went viral. It was everywhere.
I used to tell my father, you will see one day, I will make a film and I will go to Cannes. I don't know why I say that.
I felt insulted.
I was like, where is my audience?
I didn't go to therapy. I think I should.
This is El Empire. Stories of exceptional Arabs around the world and their journey to the top. Hibe, hi.
Hi, Dana.
So who do we have today?
We're talking to another rock star female founder. And this one, she's shaking up the fashion industry. Can you tell me, like, in your PR language, what the modist is? Like, one line.
In my PR language?
I have different languages. The modist is the first and only luxury destination for modest fashion globally, built on values of diversity, inclusivity, and empowering women.
My name is Rizlan Guinness. I'm Algerian. I am 40 years old, and I am founder and CEO of The Modist. Modist actually is a lover of fashion. So it's actually a play on word between modesty and modist, which speaks to the love of fashion. So, but you can pronounce it whatever. Call us whatever you want to call us.
No, I learned a new word today. That's
yeah,
awesome.
That's what it means, yeah.
Our guest this week is Rizlan Guinness. She started the world's first modest fashion retailer, The Modist, in 2017. And when we say modest fashion, we mean clothes that may be long-sleeved, go down past your bum, but are also seriously fashionable. Luxury modest fashion is a massive industry in the tens of billions of dollars, and The Modist is a pioneer in this space.
And they're killing it. Rizlan wouldn't disclose how much The Modist has raised so far, but they're on their second round of funding. They ship to 120 countries, and they have very happy customers. Rizlan is also a lovely person. I really enjoyed speaking with her. It was like chatting with an old friend, even though this interview was actually the first time we had ever met. Rizlan joined me in our studios in Dubai. I feel like I should add the disclaimer that this was pre-corona. And I wouldn't care to comment on what someone was wearing, except she's the founder of a fashion empire, so it seems appropriate. She rocked up in black leather pants and a leopard print blouse and looked gorgeous.
Are we starting the podcast?
Today on El Empire, how to build a fashion empire. Earlier, you were telling me about your morning routine. Can you tell me a bit about that now that we're recording? What do you do first thing in the morning? What kind of rituals do you have?
Yeah, so I mean, I started about a year and a half ago waking up really early. So I used to be a night owl, and now I'm definitely an early bird. I wake up around 5:30 in the morning. I have two, I call them my sacred hours, my 2 hours a day that are not interrupted. When I wake up, I don't look at my phone. The first thing I do is, you know, get right into my routine. So I meditate, I journal, I like listening to podcasts or a book.
Yeah, I think I would love to try that because I have a horrible habit where my phone is my alarm. And so that's the first thing I grab. And then, of course, it's a bright light in your face. And then I spend probably 20 minutes checking all the notifications and getting stressed out. And that's
no,
the first thing I do.
It's the worst thing. Yeah. Like, forget meditation, forget anything. If there's one tiny little step you want to do in the morning, first of all, your alarm should not be scary, screaming alarm. That's the first thing. You don't want to wake up your mind with that, like, kind of crazy sound. And then the second thing is just don't look at your phone. Don't look at your emails, in social media. Nothing is going to change. The world is not going to stop. Any emergency, you're going to receive a call. But it makes so much of a difference. It just helps you start the day with the right state of mind.
What was your childhood like? Can you tell me about the household you grew up in? Are you an only child? Tell me about your parents.
Sure.
Yeah, I would say it was an interesting childhood. My father was, you know, in the War of Independence of Algeria, so he spent 7 years in the battlefield. And when he, you know, when Algeria got its independence, he, you know, got into politics and had a burgeoning political career. My mother, who was much younger than him, you know, was at the time still studying. They separated when I was pretty young. I was about a year and a half or 2 years old. And so I was brought up by my maternal grandmother because my mother traveled to study and my father was, you know, in the political field. And I remember a childhood where I was, there was so much love and I was very protected as a child. And I was the only child. And you can imagine with a grandmother, how it's like. And it was a, you know, lovely, very comfortable upbringing until the age of 10. And then the age of 10, I moved to the UAE to live with my mother and my stepfather. And my stepdad had been in my life since the age of 5. And he was an entrepreneur. And life then was a bit different. So it went into, you know, seeing the hustle and seeing, you know, the entrepreneurial life. So it was nice to be exposed to, you know, that comfortable, abundant kind of, you know, upbringing, but also see what it's like to, you know, run a business and hustle and have a, you know, middle class upbringing and all of that. So, but I remember a lot of fun and a lot of laughter and a lot of happiness as a child.
So you spent a little bit of time in Algeria, a little bit of time in the UAE, and a little bit of time in Lebanon.
Correct.
Is that right? So how do you, when somebody asks where you're from, how do you answer that and what splits your identity?
Look, I'm Algerian through and through in the sense that, you know, I'm my blood is Algerian. My mother exposed me also to the Moroccan culture, so I'm very aware of that. But I spent 7 years of my teenage years and into adulthood in Lebanon, and I think it was one of the best times of my life, and I'm very influenced by Lebanon. I also grew up in a Lebanese household, so my accent is Lebanese. I think we've got more than 5-6 different nationalities in our family. So I do have that Algerian belonging, and I find that the older I get, the more nostalgic I become, especially that I don't visit often. But I also love Lebanon, and it feels like home, and I go back very often.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a performer first, like Sherihan. I was so obsessed with her that I kind of just wanted to be her. And then I wanted to be a lawyer. And then I wanted to be, you know, there were times when I wanted to be three things. You know, when we're children and they tell you what you want to be and you kind of list 4 or 5 different things. I think Gen Z is back to that now. And actually, up until, you know, growing up and graduating from school, I wasn't very clear on what I wanted to do. So I was not one of those kids who knew exactly what career line I was going to take, what I wanted to do with my life. I mean, that's when I see people like that. I'm like, amazing. I mean, it wasn't the case for me.
What about the first time that you remember being excited about fashion? How did you always look this fabulous? Like how did
Thank you? I always loved fashion, and my mother is my first memory of. It was more than fashion. It was just glam. It was just, you know, being glamorous and attractive and beautiful and the hair and the makeup and all of that. And I have this very vivid memory of my mother whenever she would come back from her travels. You know, back in the day in the 80s, when women traveled, they used to dress up. Mm-hmm. So the hair and the makeup, and now we travel in sneakers and you just want to be comfortable. And she used to walk in and that image, you know, is constantly in my mind of like the very glamorous, very fashionable, you know, woman.
And then you went to the London School of Economics for university, right? Mm-hmm. Where you studied business.
Correct.
Was that your first time away from home?
Yes and no, because I'd started working before. I didn't go to university immediately after school. I took a little bit of a break. And during that break, I was away from home. But my family was living in Abu Dhabi. I was living in Dubai. So we weren't too far.
And then, yeah, I mean, I started my studies at the LSE, and that's when I was, yeah, properly, more or less, out of home.
What did you do during that gap period between school and university?
I was working. Yeah, I went right into work. I wasn't sure I was going, you know, what I wanted to do. And I got an opportunity, and I kind of, you know, started working and then got into university. Yeah, I did it in a bit of a atypical way.
What was that first job?
It was Abraj.
Ghislaine's first job was at Abraj Capital, a huge private equity firm in Dubai that managed hundreds of millions of dollars. She started first in an admin role and moved up into branding and partnerships.
I was working with them for about 13 or 14 years. And when I started, I was like one of the first five people to be employed. And when I left, the company was huge and had about 300-400 people under its umbrella. So, and yeah, when I started, I mean, they had just opened doors, so I was doing a little bit of everything. And as I said, it was an opportunity. They were looking for, you know, to employ individuals. I think I was, you know, always a person who rolled up my sleeves. I was 19 then. I think I was about 19 or 20. And yeah, I mean, I started there. And my job when I started was very different from my job 2 years into it. You know, if you survive that business, you can pretty much do anything. It was quite tough, but in a good way. It was filled with ambitious, smart, driven people. And you kind of felt like it was a tribe. And so that discipline and that, you know, drive and that, you know, excitement to achieve and to contribute was definitely taken with me. And that's stayed with them and grew in that business for 13. I left 13 years. I left in 2015. To start the Modus.
What was the moment when you decided to leave a stable corporate job to start your own company, the Modus?
To be fair, also, the idea of the Modus had started brewing in my mind for about a year and a half or so prior to leaving my job at the time. And I mean, it was nowhere near what it is today. And it wasn't, of course, crystallized and well-formed. But it was an idea that knew had potential. I mean, I'd seen the frustration of women like my mother who dressed modestly. Myself, I worked in finance for that long. So, of course, my dress code was also conservative and more corporate, and I just knew that, you know, it's bound to be the case for many women out there who dress this way and who want options and who want a destination that is relevant to them. And I also know that, like, if something frustrates you very, very often, providing a solution is likely to be a solution for many people, not just yourself.
Yeah. Can you describe to me how, like, was there a conversation that you had with somebody about, okay, I'm going to leave what I've been doing for 13 years and essentially jump off a cliff?
Yeah.
How did that conversation go?
I mean, I spoke to, at the time, a colleague who I worked with, and I spoke to a very close friend, a couple of people. I mean, I'd say probably like around five people. Family, you know, my mother, from the perspective of, well, I'm shifting from, you know, a paid employee to running my own business. I kept it quite vague for some people because it, you know, it's not just another idea. There was nothing like it at the time. And in fact, from the time that we started working on it as a team, it took us a year to launch the business. We kept it quite, what is the word? I can't remember now, but it'll come to me.
Incognito?
Yeah, no, there's another stilt.
Stealth mode.
Yeah. That's the word. It was on stealth mode until we launched, because again, we didn't want anyone to activate on modesty before we were out there. But everyone who'd heard the idea at the outset was excited by it because it was different, but it was very simple. And the problem was very clear. And I think that that's probably the notion of every startup. Like, there's a problem and you're providing a solution. There's a need and you're providing a service.
Well, When you spoke with your mom in those early days, what did she say? Was she like, what are you doing? Or she understood because her husband had, you know, was an entrepreneur as well?
I think my mother has always been a very encouraging person. So there's always that that notion of course you can do it. Yeah, definitely, of course. Why wouldn't you be able to do it? And that I think that, you know, in hindsight, I think support system around you like that, you know, that encouragement is just invaluable in life in general, but especially when you're starting a business, because you just don't know anything. You think you know, but you don't know anything. You're in for the ride of your life. And unless you have that encouragement, whether it comes from within you or without, to take that first step, it's extremely hard to do it, because there are a million reasons for you not to do it, right?
Yeah, 100%.
You can relate. You can relate.
When we left off, Ghislain had been working on the Modest for a year in stealth mode before they were ready to launch.
First of all, I had no connections to the world of fashion or e-com. I mean, I had been in investments all of my life and finance world, so I didn't have a network there. I had a friend who was in the fashion space, and I reached out to her and she connected me with a couple of people. But the most important thing was that they all came together around the excitement, around the vision and what it was that we were doing. It wasn't a case of, let's do an e-commerce platform and let's then think about our values. It started with, this woman deserves more. She's incredible. She's amazing. She's fashionable. She's misunderstood. She's stereotyped. And we understand her. We get her. And we're going to serve her the best way we can. And we're also going to represent her in a way that has not been done before.
So when the idea started to brew for you, like, what was it? What was the pain point?
Yeah, I mean, it was the frustrating, in its simplest way, it was the frustrating shopping experience that modest dressers, both regionally and globally, experienced whenever they shopped. I mean, we're talking about women who wear the hijab, but we're also talking about women who just, you know, prefer a longer sleeve and a longer hem and covering their neckline and not showing too much. And the fact that whenever they shopped, it was very time consuming and frustrating and alienating. And, you know, they had to spend so much time to sift through so much product in order to put an outfit. And that's one part of it. But also the other part of it is that then you're really not represented in the fashion world. You're not spoken to. You don't have any inspiration. You don't see women in magazines that look like you, that dress like you. There's no content that's relevant to you. So it goes beyond just your shopping experience.
So how did you convince your first brand to join the Modest?
So we went really well prepared. And we knew that modesty was not, do you know, even the term modesty was not used. You know, people were calling it demure, people were calling it different. There was still an argument. And I remember being in a conference before we launched the business and someone had said, I am not sure modest is the right term for it. It just doesn't sound great. And I'm thinking in my head, well, Acne is not necessarily a great brand name. However, you don't necessarily now relate Acne, the brand, which is like one of the coolest brands, to a zit. You know what I mean? Like, it's a brand is what you make out of it, and modesty is what described it the best. So we knew we were going down that route, and we wanted to kind of really marry fashion and modesty, and we wanted to pull no punches when it comes to fashion whilst addressing modesty. So it was very educational for the brands. It clearly showed them the potential. They got extremely excited because they knew we were a bridge that would connect them to a customer base that they can't speak meaningfully to. And through us, they would be able to do that. But you know what? Regardless, the experience and the reaction was the same. Almost everyone did not understand what modesty was and had a stereotypical notion to what modesty is. So they would say abaya, burqa, hijab. These were the first things that came to mind. Black. And this is why, you know, we say that we break stereotypes is because we truly kind of, you know, turn it all on its head and went down the route of, no, actually, it's super fashionable and she's not conservative. That's what you think. In fashion, she actually is, and she's quite open and daring.
And you guys launched on International Women's Day 2017,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You launched the Modist on that day. So what did you launch with? What was the first iteration of the Modist?
Yeah. So we started with a teaser campaign ahead of launching. And we launched the business, as you said, on International Women's Day. And we launched with 75 brands at the time, which
That's
was, you know,
brands.
It was a lot of brands. But it was, you know, great to have all of these brands on the site. And, it was an amazing day. And whilst at the outset we thought, you know, maybe there'll be some controversy. Maybe some people will talk about it being, I don't know, like, you know, modesty is not freeing of women and is not feminist. But everybody got it. And that resonance and that reaction was very encouraging.
What happened on that first day? So you went live.
Yes.
Somebody pressed the button, so to
yeah.
speak. And then did you all hover around the website and watch traffic come
yeah.
in?
Like, how did That's that exactly what we did. We literally didn't work. I mean, literally, you'd get one order and there'll be like a massive dance in the office and a party. But I think one of the things that I learned with the Modist is to celebrate small moments. As a person, I'm not like that. I'm constantly looking at what's next. But being with a team makes you stop and celebrate for them. And you kind of then start enjoying, you know, celebrating those little moments. And that's why doing it, and you, I'm sure, Hiba, you can relate to this, doing it, you have to do it for the right reasons and for the right purpose and values. Because when it gets very overwhelming, and it will get overwhelming very quickly, when you ask the question of why am I doing all this, it kind of makes sense to you. Otherwise, you know, it's easy to give in.
How many people were working with you when you launched the Modist, and how did you finance?
So at launch, I think we were around 23, 24 people. And the financing, I mean, we seed money came in from myself, friends and family. But I very soon, you know, started fundraising.
Tell me about those conversations. What did they say when they said no? And what did they say when they said yes? And
yeah.
How did you handle both?
You know, in a business, as a startup, you're always working with what we call your runway, right? So you're working with a period of time where you know that you're alive as a business. and you know, the more no's you hear, and there are always, to every one yes, there are many, many, many no's. You know, for every no that you're receiving, you're constantly thinking about the livelihood of your business. And it's just part of the, you know, that entrepreneurial life. You can't do it any other way unless you're not fundraising at all. With us, I think the one common thing is that there isn't an investor that we pitched to who was not excited by the idea. I've heard so many no's that I'm like so good with rejection right now.
What did you do to celebrate when you closed your seed round?
God, I didn't celebrate. I was freaked out. I've got people's money. I need to deal with that. But I told you, like, celebrating for me is not very common. I have to push myself. So I got back to work quite quickly after fundraising.
What has been one of your most successful marketing campaigns, and why do you think it resonated so much?
I still feel that our launch campaign was brilliant because it just spoke the values.
Do not tell me what I am to wear, what I am to cover, my skin or my hair. Do not tell me how much is too much. I am my keeper. I follow my heart.
It was a campaign story, that spoke about, you know, modesty, and it showed women. It was filmed in London, and it showed, you know, diverse women. So older, younger, hijabi, and it featured them doing things that were a bit out of the box. And again, remember, this was like more than three years ago. So before we started seeing hijabis, ice skater and a hijabi, you know,
Nike,
in the fencing
yeah.
and all of that stuff. And we had a hijabi kind of do a dance and one on a skateboard. And it just even both visually and in terms of the script, it kind of started breaking those stereotypes, and it was uplifting. And I think because it was different, it had an impact.
I am the modist. I belong to me.
So I've read, and tell me if this statistic is incorrect,
yeah.
But I've read that the modest fashion industry is expected to hit $330 billion U.S. dollars this year in 2020. Is that an accurate estimate?
It is. I think it's slightly exaggerated, but it's. I think that figure relates to Muslim spend.
Oh, interesting.
Across probably men, women, in fashion and in everything else. So it's slightly bigger, but the industry is in the tens of billions of dollars conservatively. So it's quite a large opportunity.
So obviously you guys started here in Dubai and biggest markets are in the GCC, but the US is fast growing as a customer destination. I've read in one of the articles that your team was actually surprised by how quickly you penetrated the U.S. market. Can you talk a little bit more about that, especially in light of modest fashion and just what we see as consumer trends globally and then what your experience has been with the U.S. picking up so fast?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting and nice surprise to actually see that growth in the U.S. because, as you can imagine, I mean, it's been growing quite a bit for us. And the interesting thing is that our customers in the U.S. are predominantly, and I mean, around 95% of our customers are Western women, are American women. We're not tapping into the Middle Eastern diaspora or Muslims in the U.S. So that's what's interesting. But then, you know, American women in the states where we exist, you know, predominantly women dress in a modest way, whether she's, you know, a mom or an executive or whatever that may be. So and this goes back to the fact that modesty is quite broad and quite universal as a way of dressing and a way of life.
Do you have a work-life balance? And if yes, how do you, like, what are some tricks that you've learned to get there?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't. I've made a conscious decision to start doing that this year, and I'm trying to. But to give you a sense of how imbalanced it was, I think in 4 years of being in this business, I've taken a couple of weeks off. So it's pretty bad. But it's not something that I know that a lot of us founders and entrepreneurs and people who run businesses, you're constantly talking about how it's nonstop. And it's almost like there's a part of you that's like, yeah, I'm nonstop. I'm like, you know, your ego is taking over. But the truth is that I think in the long run, it's just you need that balance. You need that balance to thrive and to be, you know, inspiring for your team and to be there for them and to, you know, because you're living too, right? And that is a commitment that I have made to myself to look after myself and make time for, you know, for family and, you know, treasure weekends and not glorify like working on weekends and after hours, because we do that also. And I came from a culture, corporate culture, that glorified that. I think finance as an industry in general, like working weekends and I'm working until 3 a.m. is such a thing. You sound like you're complaining, but you're part of the...
You're bragging, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm generalizing, of course, but still. So I think it's... balance is not going to find you. You're going to have to find it and figure out how to bring it into your life. So my 2 hours in the morning are part of my balance. My, you know, my sacred Friday is part of my balance. You have to trust the team that you have in place, and you have to know that sometimes a short break or, you know, a bit of time off can actually take you back to being far more productive than, you know, working nonstop for a very long period.
What are some of the things that you've learned about yourself as going through this entrepreneurial journey with the Modus that you didn't know 5 years ago, four years ago?
I think I've learned to really trust myself. And, you know, I've always known that I was a strong person. Like, I'm a fighter by nature. But I think I surprised myself with how much resilience and grit I have. And I think that a lot of us, and I'm very passionate about this, a lot of us, especially women, really dumb ourselves down in terms of our capabilities and potential and what we can and can't do. And, you know, when I think back 10 years ago, or even like 7 years ago, I would have never imagined myself running a business, let alone running a business with, you know, senior people in it, with massive investors, you know, that with the turnaround that we have. And that's why I'm so passionate about, you know, all of us instilling that confidence in young girls at an early stage, because the potential that's there is massive and may never get out of there if we don't encourage them and show them.
I spoke with Ghislaine in January 2020, and since then, as you all know, the world has really changed. COVID-19 has left so many people unemployed around the world, and it's hurt a lot of businesses. In early April, the Modist announced that it was permanently shutting down after 3 years of operation. In the words of Ghislaine, the global crisis that hit the world left their young business vulnerable and with no option but to cease operating. In the weeks since, there has been an outpouring of love and support from huge fashion brands and publishers. They talk about the legacy the Modist will leave behind. As the first modest fashion company, the Modist created a category in fashion, in luxury fashion that didn't exist before. And personally, I believe whatever Ghislaine and her team decide to do next will also leave a similar lasting impact.
This episode was produced by Tamara Rasamni, Alex Atak, Hiba Fisher, and myself, Dana Balut. Sound design by Alex Atak and mixing by Mohamed Khreizat. Our original sting was composed by Ramzi Bashoud, and El Empire is produced by the Kerning Cultures Network. If you're liking El Empire, please, please, please subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. Leave us a ranking, hopefully 5 stars, and review us on whatever podcast app you're listening to us from. It really helps boost our ranking so that other listeners can find our episodes. And next week on El Empire?
I attempted to row across the Atlantic Ocean. I rode about 1,000 kilometers with my teammate before capsizing in a massive storm, the boat not self-righting, the life raft not opening, and spending 13 hours not knowing whether we would live or die.
He says casually.
which has now actually been made into a movie.
That's in 1 week.